Mark chapter 11 tonight. Just working through this. It's important when we're studying the Gospels that we not only see what Jesus is doing, because he's doing most of the stuff in the Gospels, right? But we understand what the author, by the Holy Spirit, is doing. So Matthew is not necessarily doing the same thing that Mark is doing in how they write, how each of them writes and arranges it. So that's really important because we have the Spirit has inscripturated four Gospels from four different authors for different intents and purposes. And so we need to ask that question whenever we're going through a Gospel, a book, which is why we don't usually go through Gospels. We don't usually study them in one book, in harmony sort of way. Because to do that is to miss the spiritual intent that God has. Or we're more capable or likely to miss the spiritual intent that God has. It doesn't mean that we don't look at other of the Gospels to sort of like understand some of the details, what's happening. It just means we need to think about what's Mark doing here. So John, for example, is the most Jesus-speaking gospel that we have. It's mostly Jesus talking. And half of this long book, John, is the last week of Jesus' life. So John spends more time recording Jesus' words in 1 week than most of the 3 years that he ministered. Mark, on the other hand, divides the book in half, or sort of turns the corner in thematically in chapter 8, and that's halfway through the book. And then, as we've noticed, as we've been working through Mark, he does so and expresses the thematic understanding, or some have said the melodic line of Mark, is really seen in 8, 9, and 10. Like, what's Mark's goal in those three chapters? We just finished that, and we're in 11, coming to the last week of Jesus' life. And those three sort of movements in Mark 8, 9, and 10 are with an inclusio of blind guys. So Mark 8 as a blind guy who gets sight, and then the end of Mark 10 as a blind guy who gets sight. And then between that, all the seeing people are blind. That's what Mark sort of does, that they don't see what they should see. And that's just the kind of the way in which he organizes and helps teach us something here. We also have in those three movements where Jesus, in 8 through 10, Jesus is expressing his ministry, his reason why he's come. So three times Mark arranges it as Jesus saying, I'm going to Jerusalem, I'm going to suffer, I'm going to die, I'm going to rise again. And he does it in three different ways, actually increasing in detail. And then after each one of those, remember what we have? We have the blind disciples not getting it and responding instead with a pursuit of being served in some way. We want to be in charge. It's kind of their response after each one of these. This is a very clear oversimplification, but we went through this already. And the question can arise, at least it does to my mind, why does Mark, by the Spirit of God, repeatedly show us the disciples not getting it? Why does he repeatedly show them as, quote, unquote, blind to Jesus' mission? And why in each one of those instances is it some sort of really kind of cringy, like, ooh, guys, like, let us sit at the left and right hand in your glory, in your power, and get the kids away from me. You know, it's like, whoa, like, these are pretty low-hanging fruit stuff, right? And you're like it's kind of paints them in a really bad light. That's not really the point of it, is them being painted in a bad light. I suppose there could be some encouragement in the idea that, like, well, we're like them, but I don't even think that's Mark's intent. What he's emphasizing over and over and over again in this movement is the idea of service, right? Serving. But is Mark's purpose simply to give us a moral lesson that we need to be serving people? That we just don't need to be selfish and centered on our things, but thinking about more important things and be serving? Does he spend this gospel, the second gospel, is the kind of the climax or the pinnacle of it, merely to teach us to be better servants? I don't think so, for several reasons, but one of them is that just seems to fly in the face of what I know of the gospel. The gospel is not do better. The gospels are not just be a better servant. Now, indeed, there are lessons we learn about service in it. Like, it is important that we learn that. Jesus teaches those lessons. But I don't believe that Jesus's intent or Mark's intent here is just to teach us the principles of leadership. Servant leadership, teach us what that is, so that we can go into our jobs or our families and we can be good servant leaders. No, actually, I think Mark has a more significant gospel, even theological intent in these lessons, that being kind of the climax of the gospel, are these, that Jesus says, I'm going to go suffer, and the disciples' response in some cringe response with them being served, and he responds with, no, be a servant. Like, I don't think that the intent is moral primarily. In fact, I think there's something deeper going on theologically. I think it's Levitical. I think that this is Mark using a biblical theology of Christ's service as priest, that his intent in his first incarnation is to come to serve in a predominant way. So when we talk about Jesus Christ as the servant or as a servant, we need to not think, or our responsibility as a servant even, but particularly Jesus, we need to not think in terms of, well, he's a servant like a butler or like a chauffeur, like a just like a servant who, you know, gives his seat up on the bus to someone else. It's not the idea of Jesus came to serve. He didn't come to make people's lives better in a temporal sense, to be a nice guy. Rather, the service of Jesus Christ, his servant leadership, the word for servant, and to serve or to give, has deep roots into the Levitical codes of the Old Testament. The principal servants in the Old Testament were the Levites. They were God's servants. And their service or their liturgy was a temple service. So Jesus' servant ministry is primarily, we ask the question, well, what kind of servant is Jesus? What kind of servant did he come to be? Did he come to be, you know, like a maid? Like that kind of a servant? Is that what you mean by servant? No, he came to serve as priest. He came to aid us, Hebrews, aid us in our need. To serve us by doing something for us that we couldn't do for ourselves. And that is, he came to advocate, to intercede for us before the Father. He came to serve us as priest. He's a priestly servant. It has been said that Mark's theme, it's been pretty routinely noted in commentaries, that Mark's theme is Christ as the servant, as the true servant. And we need to add to that Christ as the true priestly servant. He's the true priest. So then come back to Mark 8, 9, 10. When Jesus is teaching the disciples about service, he's not merely telling them what they should do. He's telling them and informing them, one, that they're blind and they're seeing it all wrong. They're seeing the ministry of Christ as predominantly a kingly one at this time. James and John, can we sit next to your left and right when you come in your power, your authority, your king as king? And saying, you're missing a really important part of who I am. You're blind to that. The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. He came to be priest, who is also king. And his authority as king gives him authority as priest. So what were the primary takeaway from 8, 9, and 10 should not be good servants. That's a secondary takeaway. The primary takeaway ought to be, look for the Messiah who will fully serve you. And that'll be a Messiah or a king unlike any other you've known. Because the Son of Man is different than all the others. He comes to do what you can't. And that's why I think we see the disciples falling so flat on their face. It's evident. It's basically a doctrine of Christ alone. Priest alone. The best of them couldn't get it. But Jesus Christ is the perfect servant who is the priest. So that informs as we move into this now week of his suffering. What he's been saying in 8, 9, 10 is look for the kind of Messiah. Look for the kind of Messiah that's not going to come with a sword. Look for the kind of Messiah that's not going to come, you know, to, in order and push the children away because they're of no value to the kingdom. Don't look for the kind of Messiah. Not that Messiah. Look for the Messiah that's going to come and he's going to give his life as your priest and as your sacrifice. Look for that kind of Messiah. And then chapter 11, he's like, okay, I'm here. You've been with me the whole time. Big reveal. I'm going to do what I've been saying I'm going to do all along. I'm going to do it now. It's time. Which is why last week we noted he's eager to get to Jerusalem. And the disciples in chapter 10 are think he's crazy. Because why does he want to get there so bad? They're kind of hostile to him. He's like, exactly. That's why I want to get there. Because they're hostile. Because it's time for me to do what I came here for. And that is to serve you as your priest. And so I'm going to go into the temple, and I'm going to serve you as your priest. And he's going to go into the temple with more as priest, but as more than priest. He's going to go to the temple as priest with a sacrifice. And they might say, well, where's your sacrifice? It's right here. I'm a priest who is the sacrifice. So this idea of the temple is what occupies the beginning of Mark's discussion, or Mark's writing here, regarding the next chapter, actually next couple chapters, the temple is sort of the central element here because he's the priest, the servant, 8, 9, 10, who is now going to do his service. And where does the priest do his service? In the temple. So that's what this is. So you could outline 11 this way. Let me get the pen that works here. So verses 1 through 11, Christ's authority, this is not going to surprise you. 1 through 11, he's got authority. And then 12 through 14, strange big business about a fig tree. And then 15 through 19, Christ's authority. And then 20 through 26, even stranger business about a fig tree. And then 27 through 33, I wonder if you can guess what this word is going to be. His authority. That's how you outline this text. And this authority is the priestly authority. So the Levites, the priests, actually had swords. Not the high priest in doing his Yom Kippur didn't carry a sword, but the priests, they had swords. You remember even David went to in this trying to run from Saul, and he got a sword from the priests, a Goliath sword. They kept that, and one of the things that the priests was they had two jobs. One, they were to do the service, but they also were to protect the temple. They were to protect the temple from pollution. Remember the priests that are regarded as heroic in the Bible for doing some pretty violent things against those who were polluting the temple, running them through with a javelin because there was fornication in the temple. Priests were warriors. The Levites were warriors. They were God's portion or his heirs. He called their mine. They were to protect his holiness in the temple, even from themselves. If they were to disobey and become unholy, their lives were forfeit. So the idea of the holy priests protecting the temple, it's their job, the first job. Interestingly, if you want to do a biblical theology, this was Adam's error in the garden. Adam is the first royal priest. He is to represent God to the cosmos as the image bearer of God. And he's in God's garden temple all through Jewish history and even the book of Revelation. God's temple is all garden-like. God's garden temple. And one of the jobs that Adam had was to, the primary job was to protect God's garden temple from pollution. And, or you might say in a perhaps proverbial way, to protect it from snakes. And he couldn't and didn't. And he failed as the royal priest. He was supposed to have dominion, and he was supposed to represent God as the image bearer, and he didn't. Jesus is now going to God's temple. He calls it my Father's house, or my house, here in this text. But he's going to protect it. He's going to drive out the snakes. He's going to command what's done there. He takes charge of the temple as the perfect and appropriate high priest. So authority is priestly authority. Now, this priestly authority, we don't want to limit him to just priestly authority, and that's what we're going to see is actually interesting how this plays itself out. But let's just, we're not going to go in depth into anything in this chapter because I want us to see the bigger picture of it. I think sometimes it helps us that way, and even though we can, there's a lot of stuff that we could talk about, and there's stuff here that's very unique. But I'm going to try to kind of see the bigger picture of what's happening textually. So what do we have starting in chapter 11:1? We have the very famous triumphal entry. Now, when they drew near Jerusalem to Bethphage and Bethany at the Mount of Olives, he sent two of his disciples, and he said to them, "Go into the village opposite you, and as soon as you have entered it, you will find a colt tied on which no one has sat, loose it and bring it. And if anyone says to you, 'Why are you doing this?' say, 'The Lord has need of it,' and immediately he will send it here." So they went their way and found the colt tied by the door outside on the street, and they loosed it. Some of those who stood there said to them, what are you doing, loosing the colt?" They spoke to them just as Jesus had commanded, so they let them go. And they brought the colt to Jesus and threw their clothes on it, and he sat on it. And many spread their clothes on the road, and others cut down leafy branches from the trees and spread them on the road. And those who went before and those who followed cried out, saying, "Hosanna! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is the kingdom of our father David that comes in the name of the Lord. Hosanna in the highest." And Jesus went into Jerusalem, into the temple. So when he had looked around at all things, as the hour was already late, he went out to Bethany with the 12. Mark 11:3, Jesus tells the disciples he sends in when they're saying, what are we going to do when someone tries to stop us from stealing their animal? Tells them to say to him, to them, "The Lord has need of it." And that is going to have the power that the people are going to say, "Take it." What is most interesting about that verse is that this is the only time, this occasion, it's recorded in also the other Gospels, the only time where Jesus refers to himself as the Lord. Usually he refers to himself as the Son of Man. Gospel writers refer to him as the Lord. Others refer to him as Lord. But this is the only time Jesus refers to himself as the Lord, which is the equivalent of Yahweh, like God. What's the significance of this? Well, he's eager to get to Jerusalem. He's done the teaching part of his ministry, and now he's expressing his absolute authority as the Lord. And this authority is seen, first of all, in the fact that without explanation, when the Lord commands, people follow. So the owners of the colt don't even ask for an explanation, which Lord? They don't know. There's power that Jesus promises them in simply when he says, "Say, the Lord has need." And almost as if the owners of the animal are suddenly just struck with a sense of, okay, take it. So there is a fiat sort of authority in this idea. He declares, and it happens. The word command is used here. That's not used very often also regarding Jesus, though it's usually used regarding the wind and the waves and disease and unclean spirits. And here, Jesus commands his disciples. And then you have in this text the unique situation that for some apparently unexplained reason, all these crowds going to Jerusalem for the Passover suddenly decide to make Jesus king. This is what this is happening here. This is a coronation. This is an enthronement. He's riding on a king's animal. Kings often would ride on donkeys. Usually during peacetime, they'd ride on donkeys. And this is a donkey that's untrained, and so there's power there as well. So everything about this. And then what they're saying, blessed is the kingdom of our father David. Those are very royal sort of words, right? The kingdom, David. We just see this here. So Jesus enters into the temple as king. He enters the temple as king. And he's recognized as such by crowds. As the king, he enters the temple, he looks around, and then he leaves. Next day, we have this strange fig tree situation, which is very weird. I mean, from our perspective, I don't want to disparage the word of God. I mean, it seems weird. And it has a pear, and something happens between it. So let's just skip the fig tree for just a minute and talk about what happens the next day after he gets in the temple. That's verse 15. So they came to Jerusalem, it's the next day. Then Jesus went into the temple. You see, it's the same thing, right? Went into the temple and began to drive out those who bought and sold in the temple and overturned the tables of the money changers and seats of those who sold doves. And he would not allow anyone to carry wares through the temple. Then he taught, saying to them, is it not written, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations, but you have made it a den of thieves. And the scribes and chief priests heard it and sought how they might destroy him, for they feared him, because all the people were astonished at his teaching. When evening had come, he went out of the city. So similar scenario, goes into the temple, but this time instead of looking around, he does some stuff. And then he goes back out of the city. What it says he was in the temple, this is the temple complex. Not in the holy place. But that's why they're walking through and buying and selling and stuff like that. This is the complex in and around the Temple Mount, not just the building itself. And what he's doing in here is he is establishing, well, there's a text that kind of clues us in. If the phrase, the Lord has need of it, and blessed is the kingdom of our father David. If these are telling us or cluing us into the realities that he's describing Christ as king, is there anything in this text that's cluing us into what the emphasis is? What Jesus says, usually when you're reading a narrative, when the main character speaks, that's like a clue that this is an important, this is like climax or central to the narrative. So Jesus, the climax is not him, of the narrative, is not him overturning the tables and throwing people out. It's when he says why he's doing it. And he says, is it not written, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations, but you have made it a den of thieves. So, and then notice, who are the people who are most offended? So do you see the connection there? The scribes are the ones that study the scripture, and Jesus quotes scripture at them, right? And then, who are the, or let me put it this way, the house or the building, the temple, and the priests. So there's this like thing going on here where we're seeing Jesus is addressing the error of the scribes and the priests. They're not doing their job. And so he takes over and he does the job that needs to be done. And it goes on to not just that he's going to overturn the tables and drive out the money changers, but that phrase I mentioned last week that is found only in Mark, where he says, and he doesn't let anybody pass through the temple without checking what they're doing. I mean, that is so different and awesome. I'm just picturing in my head, like Jesus, like inspecting everyone that people are holding in their hands as they're walking around. What do you got in your hands there? Did you buy that here? Where'd you buy that? Is that for? Okay, you go, you stay. Like, he's like doing something that's very unique to what we've seen Jesus do all along, right? What's he doing? He's doing what Adam didn't do. He's driving out the snakes, right? He's protecting his house from evil. He's coming and he's expressing his authority as priest. Some of you are already like thinking ahead and you're already on the next paragraph. And you wouldn't be wrong, I don't think. Let's read the next paragraph. Not the fig tree. We're going to come back to that. Let's read 27. This is the third day. Then they came again to Jerusalem. So we know it's the third day. So that happened, third day. Come again to Jerusalem. And he was walking in the temple. Do you see how temple, like each one of these is temple, temple, temple? And he was walking in the temple. The chief priests, the scribes, and the elders came to him. And they said to him, by what authority are you doing these things? And who gave you this authority to do these things? But Jesus answered and said to them, I will also ask you one question. Then answer me, and I will tell you by what authority I do these things. The baptism of John, was it from heaven or from men? Answer me. And they reasoned among themselves, saying, if we say from heaven, he will say, then why did you not believe him? But if we say from men, they feared the people, for all counted John to have been a prophet indeed. So they answered and said to Jesus, we do not know. And Jesus answered and said to them, neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things. Now, what's fascinating to me about this text as well is what Jesus is doing is the exact thing, righteously and in reverse, that they've been doing to him for the last 3 years. They constantly are coming at him, right, to trip him up, to ask him a question. They're like, we got him, because if he says this, then this is going to happen. But if he says this, this is going to happen. Like, if he says divorce for any reason, then, we got him there. If he says no divorce, we got him there. And he does that to them. He basically says, okay, I got a question for you. And they're like, oh no, he's trapped us. Because if we say this, then he's going to say this. But if we say this, the people are going to say this. And we don't have a good answer that's going to appease both sides. Kind of like getting a taste of their own medicine of what they've been doing all along here. So besides the fact that it's fun to see Jesus, who has willingly submitted himself for the last 3 years. And this is maybe just my flesh speaking. It's fun to see him kind of like punch back before he gets crucified, right? But demonstrating once again, you guys thought you've had me all this time. You've never had me. I was giving you the, I was allowing you to think you had some authority, but I have authority here in this temple. It's mine. So the word authority appears frequently in here. So what he essentially does here is he takes on another mantle in this section. And the mantle that he takes on is the mantle of prophet. Even to the fact we see a connection, the connection to John, the greatest prophet of the Old Covenant. And so Jesus uses that to launch into his teaching as the greatest prophet in the New Covenant. And he demonstrates to them, I'm a better prophet than you are. I'm a better prophet than anybody else. You can't answer me. I win. Now, it's not petty. Don't misunderstand what Jesus is doing here. It's not petty. It's not revenge. It's skill. It's righteous cunning. And it's also demonstrating that he has absolute prophetic authority. This is also the first time we see this, these three, it's not the first time. It's one of the few times we see chief priests, scribes, and elders. It's like everyone's coming at him. And he silences all of them with a word. Because he's perfect prophet. So what we actually see what Mark's doing as, I think, as he moves, the transitions to the Passion Week, he's presenting Christ as the Jesus, as the Christ the King, the authority of Jesus as Christ the King, the authority of Jesus as Christ the Priest, and the authority of Jesus as Christ the Prophet, Prophet, Priest, and King. He's all the Messiah is supposed to be. But that's not the only expression of his authority, because we have two other parts to this story, right? The weird part. So let's now look at the fig tree. I think the reason why the fig tree section is divided into two is one, first and foremost, it's rhetorical, it's literary. It's so that we can see this kind of interesting outline. Mark's outlining it this way for us. So we can kind of emphasize, see the king, priest, prophet sort of emphasis through here. Also, though, I think it's practical, because what Jesus does when he curses the fig tree is not evident until the next day. And so it's sort of like, happens as they're leaving it dark. As they're going in the morning, early morning, and then the next morning, they go there, they come back in the dark. Next morning, they're like, oh, the fig tree that we saw yesterday is now completely withered up. Let's look at this account and try to understand what's happening here. And I will say that for me, this is probably one of the most difficult accounts in Mark to fully grasp and understand. There's still things about it I don't get. So I hope that's something we can work through. So let's talk about what happens. So, verse 12. Now the next day, so this is day two, this is Monday, when they had come out of Bethany, he was hungry. And seeing from afar a fig tree having leaves, he went to see if perhaps he would find something on it. When he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not yet the season for figs. In response, Jesus said to it, "Let no one eat fruit from you ever again," and his disciples heard it. So here's the trouble spots. Okay, it's the only recorded miracle of Jesus where he destroys something. Every miracle of Jesus, he's creating, causing, bringing life, healing, and here he's killing. It's the only one that he does that. So that's unique and a bit troubling. But what makes it most troubling, and this is why a lot of commentators like just can't even deal with this one, is one phrase. Can you identify that phrase that's most troubling to you? Yeah. Why is that troubling? Okay. Okay. You gotta know. Okay, of course we're dealing with trouble of the two natures of the Christ, right? He's both man and God. And so we are referring to according to his humanity. You know, that's what kind of like, well, he should have known, and he's expecting something that shouldn't be there. What do you think, Dustin? Okay. So one of the things that has, he said, is producing leaves and giving false evidence. One of the things that's troubled commentators is that people are constantly trying to find a horticulture reason for this. And I read one scholar who was like, opinions abound from Bible scholars regarding the horticulture, like the growing, and no one's really sure like what's supposed to be or not supposed to be. Like, should it have had all these leaves at this time? Was it an early spring one? And then some have suggested, well, there was some early fruit you could have eaten. It's a little bit not fully ripe yet, but they could cook it up. Like, people have all these sort of like theories out there. And it's just, it's hard sometimes to know exactly what was going on 2,000 years ago in, you know, the gardening of the first century when we're so far removed. And so that's a tough one to like know. Like, was it supposed to have these leaves? Is it not supposed to have these leaves? And to speak with dogmatism on it is tough on that part of it. For me, the most troubling part about it is it seems, and I'm not saying this is true, I'm saying this is the troubling part. It feels petty, right? Like, yeah, like why, emotional. Like Jesus, why did you like curse the fig tree when it wasn't even doing anything wrong? Like, it's not even the season for figs. Like, why would you do that? It seems kind of like he's taking out his frustration of the temple or that stuff on a defenseless tree, you know. To be honest, that's the most like troubling, and that's what most commentators like try to figure out. So I don't know all that's going on here. I don't understand everything about it. But that may be part of the solution. Is the mystery of it. When you take it in its entirety of the context, I start to see some like connections here. One, if this is and this is my interpretive lens at which I'm looking at this, I understand, and I hope you understand, I'm talking interpretively. If one of the purposes of Mark, and I think it is to portray Christ as the perfect priest, as the true priest, and this idea of the priest being what Adam was not, then the idea of a fig tree, a tree with leaves, sort of starts making some connections to a garden temple, Adam. Like, there's some connections there. I'm not saying it's an allegory. I'm saying I'm just seeing some literary biblical connections. And then if Adam was to tend the garden of God, that was his job, right? And he didn't. He let a snake in. And here, and what was the result? What did God do as a result of Adam and Eve sinning and not obeying? What did God do? He cursed, but who did he curse or what did he curse? He cursed the earth, right? He didn't actually technically curse Adam and Eve. He cursed the earth. And of course, they have sort of a secondary effect of the curse because they're from the earth. So everything is going to affect them in a cursed way. And I'm wondering if there's not a connection theologically. Mark is a great biblical theologian. If there's not a connection here with this, even this Adam, and Christ is the second Adam or the ultimate true and better Adam, in that he comes and he curses the earth in Jerusalem just before he is about to bear the curse in his own body. So most commentaries see this that way or see it in a similar way and say we clearly something is happening here that is symbolic. Clearly something is happening here that is not just because of Jesus was angry at a tree. And I think they're right. I don't think he's angry at the tree in the sense of like he's just a petulant, like a petulant child, you know, kicking the tree because it's on his way in. I think they're right when they're saying he's teaching something. There's something else here, and he's doing it for a purpose rather than just a purposeless, I just am upset about the food. So I think interpretations that say, oh, well, there should have been some, at least a little bit of fruit on it, but there wasn't any of that. I think it's just speculating. Like, it's like, well, we don't know what was with the tree. But what Dustin said earlier, I think is important. It identifies in the story, it has leaves. And most scholars have suggested that this is an image of Israel, of the old creation, that full of the promise of life, but no actual fruit. And that what we see in the context, he goes into the temple complex and it's busy. People coming and going, buying and selling, sacrifices galore. When I was in Israel in 2018, we were able to see when Titus had his soldiers, Roman soldiers in 70 AD, throw stones, the temple stones off the temple, and they crushed these little shops. You can actually see they're these like old shops, ancient first century shops, are underneath temple stones there. And so what you